2 weeks ago, when we met for our study, we looked at the issue of Paul's change in identity from Saul to Paul, and we talked at length about all of the things that are behind that in light of the rather profound theological implications, because Saul in the Old Testament was a representative of an endemic or systemic problem that was deeply seated in the psyche of Israel as a nation, and of course all the individuals in it, that was apparently a problem of such magnitude that it was never corrected. God just said of the people when they sought Saul, "They've been doing this to me ever since Egypt." That had been 400 something years. And of course, the cataclysmic development of that was the crucifixion of Jesus, because he was their God and they hated him. But they would never say that out loud. They would never accept his claim to be their God, so they didn't have to be up front in their attitude. But the fact is, they did hate him. And in that Saul-Paul thing, we found that the fundamental issue was the striving after the position of being in demand, so that the Saul was the guy that was sought after for what he could give you. And Paul said, all of that stuff is self-seeking, glory-seeking stuff, and I don't want to have anything else to do with it, period. So Paul was the alternative. There's a couple of texts that I want you to be aware of as we go into our study this evening that build off of that. One of them is John 7, verse 18. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is recorded by John as saying, "He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there's no unrighteousness in him." Verse 18 makes this critical statement about motivations. And he says this, "If a person is speaking from himself, he's seeking his own glory." And the rest of the statement basically means, and you can't trust him. Because it says the one who seeks the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there's no unrighteousness in him. So if you're seeking the glory of the one who sent you, then you're being true to his delegation of you to your task, and there's no wrong in your relating to him, because you're not seeking for yourself, you're seeking for him. And the alternative is true, is if a person is speaking from himself and seeking his own glory, you can't trust him, because he's not going to be truthful and he's not going to be righteous. So anybody who is into whatever they're into for their own self-promotion is untrustworthy. Jesus said that. And of course, he was nailing the Pharisees to the wall when he said that, because they were the most self-seeking, ambitious, prideful, glory-seeking men on the planet. That's the way Paul described them, and he had been one of them. Now, in conjunction with that, in Galatians chapter 6, at the end of the book, Paul just makes this comment about the motivations of those who are teaching this false doctrine to the Galatians. He says this, "Those who desire to make a good showing in the flesh," what is that? Reputation building, "try to compel you to be circumcised, simply that they may not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. For those who are circumcised don't even keep the law themselves, but they desire to have you circumcised that they may boast in your flesh." In other words, they're building their own reputation. They're teaching false doctrine to influence you to follow along with what they're doing, because it will enhance their reputation the more followers they get. So, motivation's crucial. And that's why in Galatians chapter 1, we've zeroed in on Paul being a man who rejected his former identity, because the former identity as a Saul meant he was out for his own glory. And Paul said, "I have nothing more to do with that, period. I don't want to be in that class or category ever anymore, because it corrupts everything about you. It's a systemic problem." In the letter of 1 John, he calls it the pride of life, but that's a whole different study. Point is, that was where we were coming from, because the issue in verse 1 of the first word is motivation. Now, the second word, if you skip the little and, which is an English thing, the second word in the text is apostle. Paul an apostle. And he seems to be just completely undercutting what he just did. Because he says, I want to be the little guy, the insignificant guy, the guy who's not in it for his own reputation. I'm not trying to build, I'm not after anything you've got to give me. I'm not stalling you. And then he turns right around and uses one of the most potent words for New Testament authority that you can use. And that's the word apostle. So he puts himself right up at the top. So what we have to recognize is that on the one hand, the word Paul, the name, is a presentation of motivation. The word apostle is a presentation of the status that he holds, not by his own doing, but by God's, for a reason. This evening, we're going to look at this self-identity thing from Paul's perspective as he calls himself an apostle in relation to his readers. He says he's an apostle not through the agency of a man or of man, but through Jesus Christ. He wasn't sent from men. He got his apostleship through Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead. So he's relating himself to the readers as an apostle of the resurrected one. So we want to focus on the question, what's the significance of his identification of himself as an apostle and what difference does it make to us? So we'll start with the word apostle. That's a word that means to be sent away from. The implication is that the person has been commissioned to do something. And in the way that word is originally coined to be serviceable to the writers, it referred to somebody who was being commissioned to be a substitute in the place of someone else so that they could act in the place of the one who was sending them. So you were an apostle if you were a substitute for the person who was sending you in terms of some issue of activity so that you could accomplish something for them because they weren't there to accomplish it. They'd sent you to do it. Because for whatever reason, they weren't going to be there to do it. And the idea of apostle was that you were going to initiate or instigate or accomplish some task as the substitute for the person who sent you. And even in the culture of the first century, that was a fairly potent thing. It was kind of like power of attorney in our culture, where you could actually sign for somebody else and you could sign their wealth away. In the first century, an apostle could marry a person for the one who sent him, and the one who sent him was obligated to the marriage by the fact that the one that did it was an apostle of his. So that was a position of serious responsibility. And the idea of apostle is focused on accomplishing some task, getting something done for someone else as a substitute. And those are the two ideas that are there. Getting something done for someone else as their substitute. Those are the two concepts. Now, in the words of Luke, who was Paul's sidekick for most of his ministry time, we have in Luke's gospel a fairly detailed argument and presentation for what it means to be an apostle, and that's where we're going to go for the majority of our thinking this evening in light of this idea of Paul being an apostle, because as a pretty long-term student of the narratives of Scripture, I mean, I decided in 1974 that I was going to be preaching in one of the Gospels for the rest of my life, which locked me into the preaching of historical narrative as at least a part of my preaching ministry for the rest of my life. And I've done that up until we left Luke and I've been preaching in one of the Gospels for, 25 or 6 or 7 years. The point being, I have discovered that if you can see the meaning of a term in the picture of the historical reality of it working out, that it sometimes settles a whole lot better than if it just in some epistle somewhere running into the words. So I want us to go to Luke. I want us to start in Luke 6 and look at the opening statement about apostles that Luke gave us when he was recording Jesus' ministry. In Luke chapter 6, Jesus had gone up on a mountain and he had spent the whole night in prayer. And in verse 13 it says, when day came, he called his disciples to him and he chose 12 of them whom he named apostles. The word named is the verb for communicating an identity. So these men that he chose were going to be identified as this word apostles. And we're given their names, Simon and Andrew and James and John and so on. Now, that's important because it says in chapter 6, verse 13, that he chose these 12 and named them apostles. In chapter 9, we have the first or the beginning record of the actual activity, because the word apostle means to send them from you to accomplish a task for you as your substitute. That's the idea of the word. So if you're an apostle, you've been sent by somebody to do something that they want done as their substitute in the doing, because they're not there. In chapter 9 of Luke's record, this is the first time that we're told that Jesus sent his disciples off to do something. So this is, chapter 9 is the record of, it's the historical picture of an apostle. And I want us to notice what it says. In verse 1 of chapter 9, it says, he called the 12 together. He gave them power and authority over all the demons and to heal diseases. And then he sent them out to proclaim the kingdom of God and to perform healing. So this was the task that he was sending them to do. He wanted them to proclaim the kingdom and heal. That's the job they were going to do in his place or in his stead as his substitute, because he wasn't going to be there. He was sending them to towns that he wasn't going to. That's our introduction to the idea that he is going to commission someone else to stand in his stead. Now, I want you to notice how important that is, according to verse 5. As for those who do not receive you, as you go out from that city, shake off the dust from your feet as a testimony against them. And basically that means, in effect, we're witnessing against you that you have rejected what we've attempted to do in your presence for your acceptance. We're shaking the dust off our feet to say, in effect, we gave you your chance, we gave you your opportunity, we did what our sender told us to do, we accomplished his task in his place by his authority, and you don't like it, so you're going to have to live with the consequences of your rejection. That's what the shaking of the dust off their feet meant. The point that I want to make is this. According to verse 5, if you reject the apostles, you reject the one who sent them. That's key. But it's also scary as the dickens. Because everybody knows apostles aren't perfect. So what do you do with the problem of being subject to the ministry of an apostle, not liking particularly perhaps what they have done or said in your midst, but you're now accountable to the message you've heard and the actions that have been taken as if the one who sent them was there doing it himself. You're liable. Now, I want to show you how crucial that is in chapter 9. Now, all of Luke chapter 9 is about this apostleship thing. And in chapter 10, it's kind of repeated, because chapter 10, he takes 70 more and he sends them out. So chapter 9 is a whole unit together. And one of the key issues in chapter 9 is the record of Jesus taking three of his disciples up on the Mount of Transfiguration and giving them a visual proof beyond dispute that he was who he said he was. They saw him transformed into the Shekinah of the Old Testament glory of God. And they heard a voice from heaven saying, "This is my son, listen to him." They were, in a very real sense, three of them, given as strong a proof as you could have that Jesus was who he said he was. I mean, people wonder if Jesus really is the Son of God, if he's, you know, the Creator. The proof was given to at least three people. Foundational. Now, while they're up on the mountain, while Jesus and these three are up there, nine of the men who are his apostles, who have gone out and preached the kingdom and healed and even raised the dead. In some records it says that. They have a man come to them down on the plain below the mountain where Jesus and the disciples, others three are. And he says, I have a son who's demon possessed, and he is tormented by this demon. The way he's treated by this demon is horrible, and I'm desperate for him to be delivered. And I'm bringing him to you to deliver him. So the nine attempt an exorcism of this demon, and the demon refuses to leave. Now, I want you to remember what we read there in chapter 9, verse 1. He called the 12 together and gave them power and authority over all the demons. The nine are down here below the mountain, and in verse 37 and following, this man comes to the nine and he wants them to exercise a demonstrated authority that they've already exercised. They've already done this multiple times in their commission. He says, I want my son released from this demon. I want you to deliver him. And they, in effect, say, okay. And so they say the words to the demon that he has to leave. And the demon, no, I ain't going nowhere. He probably even used bad English. I ain't going nowhere. And they said, but you have to. We are commanding you to. And he said, deal with it. I'm not going anywhere. Now, this is all barrelism. I mean, you know. So, after the demon obviously isn't going anywhere, and they can't do anything about that, they get into this big discussion, and the dad is just blown away. So when Jesus comes back down off the mountain, he runs up to Jesus, and he says, Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He's my only son, my only boy. And a spirit seizes him, and he screams, and it throws him into convulsions, and he foams at the mouth, and it mauls him, and it scarcely leaves him or allows him to have any kind of rest or whatever. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they couldn't. Now that is the travesty. They're apostles. He has given them authority over all the demons. What's gone on? What's wrong? This is not some kind of super demon that they didn't, I mean, wasn't covered under the commission. Jesus' reaction in verse 41 is very telling. He says this, O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here. Now, when he said that, he was talking to everybody, including the nine. Because there's only one reason that the nine couldn't cast the demon out, and that is that they had forsaken the commission that was rooted in his authority and had assumed it to themselves. In effect, they were saying, oh yeah, that's no trick. We've been doing that. That's easy. Bring your boy over here. We'll do this. And in all of that attitude, the demon saw that they were into reputation building for themselves. They weren't depending on the authority of Jesus. They thought they had the power in themselves. He saw this in their demeanor and in their speech, and he knew he didn't have to obey them. So he didn't. And it just blew. I mean, they were embarrassed to death. And that was probably their, you know, when you're focused on yourself and you're into reputation building, it's pretty easy to get embarrassed. Because if anybody exposes you, you're embarrassed. Well, when Jesus got there and made that statement of rebuke, he cast the demon out. And then immediately it says, while everybody was marveling in verse 43, he said to his disciples, let these words sink down into your ears. In other words, guys, you haven't got it yet. And what he wants to sink down into their ears has to do with his own future about being delivered into the hands of men. But they didn't understand this, verse 45. And it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about it. And all that proves is they were still on their ego trip. I'm not going to ask him. I'll look like an idiot. You want to know, you ask him. You can look like the fool. I ain't asking him. All that is self-protective stuff to keep from ever finding out the truth. I mean, for crying out loud. I ask it this way in one setting. Would you rather look like an ignorant fool and get the truth, or be an ignorant fool? Because those are your options. You can either ask and find out, or you can refuse to ask because you're too embarrassed and never know. Well, this is what's going on, but what's going on here in the bigger picture is this is Luke chapter 9. This is about apostles. This is why Paul said he was an apostle. The problem with claiming to be an apostle is they're not perfect. And if somebody claims they're an apostle, they're saying, you've got to believe me, or you're going to suffer the consequences from the one that sent me. But how in the world am I supposed to know if you really are or not, when you may, by your own behavior, deny your apostleship? That's what these nine did. By their own self-seeking, they frustrated the power and authority that Jesus had given to them, and they couldn't do their job. Well, what about the man whose son was still demon-possessed? Where was his faith going to be now? Shot to thunder. Because these apostles of Jesus just dropped the ball so big that time that the father says, oh no, what do I do now? In fact, in Mark's record, he actually says to Jesus, if you can do anything, please help. And Jesus said, yes. So it was the apostles' failure that caused the father's faith to just spin down to almost nothing. In fact, he cried out to Jesus, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. I want my son healed, whatever it takes. It wasn't an ego thing for him. He was desperate. But the point I'm trying to make in all of this is that there are problems with the apostolic function identified clearly in Luke. And the big problem, as it's identified by Jesus' own words, is, oh, unbelieving. Now, that means that we need to back up in chapter 9 to verses 3 and 4. Because Jesus commissioned these 12 guys to go out on this as apostles. Power and authority over all the demons, heal diseases, prove that you are my apostles by showing it in the supernatural way. He sent them out, and they were going to go. But before they went, he said this, leave all your credit cards at home. Don't take any spare tires. Don't take any extra cash. Don't take any peanut butter and crackers. Don't take anything that you're going to anticipate that you may need 6 hours after you've left to go do what I'm telling you to do. Just go do it. And when you get to wherever you're going for the day, somebody will invite you into their home, and when they do, you just go there. And you do your ministry in that area, and you use that as your base of operation, and you don't flit around trying to find a little bit better motel or whatever. Somebody with a little nicer home to keep you, or the bed's a little softer. Just whenever you're invited, you go there, you stay there until you're finished, and then you leave from there. Now, I want you to think about being in their shoes and ask yourself whether you could do that. He's basically told them they cannot take anything with them that they're going to anticipate they might. They can't take a snack to eat on the way because they might get hungry. In the text here, you can't take two tunics means you can't plan on spending the night out in the open. Forget that. You can't take a staff or money or bread. You can't take anything that's going to make it possible for you to meet any need that comes up. And what he was doing, this is not a pattern for everybody afterwards. I mean, in Luke, Jesus said, when I did that, did you have any need or did you have any lack? And they said, no.
He said, well, now I want you to take a staff. I want you to take a purse. I want you to take the extra shoes. I want, you know, get a sword and make all your preparations for the possibles in the future. But when I did that in the first place, I was doing it because this is the first time you were going to function as apostles, and I wanted you to understand something very fundamental to the entire process, and that is, when I tell you to do something, you can do it if you will trust me. Period. And I want to prove that to you by requiring that you not have anything you can fall back on that you've taken along with you. If you run into any kind of a need after you've left to go on this job, I'm going to be your resource. I will meet it. I will provide for you. You won't be spending the night outside in any of the nights. You won't need two tunics ever on this whole journey. Every time you go into a town, somebody's going to invite you to their home to stay. Every need you have, every time you're needing a meal, somebody's going to provide it. If you need new sandals, somebody's going to give you a pair. If you're, you know, if you can't, you can't get over the next hill because your staff is broken or whatever, somebody will loan you one. It doesn't matter. Whatever you're going to need, you're going to have. I'm going to make sure that that's his fundamental requirement at the initial initiation. Why? Because they were apostles, which meant they were going to represent him. And to represent him, they had to have confidence in him that was unmarred. They had to be able to say, okay, I'll trust you here, I'll trust you there, I'll trust you everywhere because I don't know what's coming, so I'll just trust you. If a person could do that, he could be an apostle. But if he couldn't, he couldn't. Because if you don't embrace the integrity of the one who sent you to the degree that you can embrace what he considers valuable and what he considers true, then you're going to be producing a message that communicates what you think is valuable and what you think is true. And you will be a perverted apostle because you won't be representing the one who sent you. You'll be representing yourself. Luke chapter 9 is the divinely inspired record of the historical reality of Jesus getting men to the position where they could actually function as his apostles. He sent them out as apostles, gave them power and authority. They could have done it if they were willing to trust him, but they didn't have that kind of faith yet. So it was through the process that he was going to build into them the kind of faith that would be necessary so that they could function as legitimate apostles. And keep this in mind. Before Jesus ever let these guys really function as his apostles in the final sense, I mean, after he was going to be gone, and they were going to be left to do the work, before he ever left, he said, don't you leave this town to go do what I've told you to do until you receive the Spirit of God from on high, because you won't be able to do it. And that meant that the Spirit's ministry to them as apostles was going to undergird their ability to trust him so that they could present what he considered to be valuable and what he considered to be true to the people that they ministered to. Everybody who heard a legitimate apostle of Jesus discovered out of his words what Jesus considered to be valuable, what Jesus considered to be true. That's the impact of an apostle. So, the issue of this apostleship thing is that when Paul claimed to be an apostle in Galatians 1:1, he was saying, you can trust what I told you as if Jesus himself told you. And who is Jesus? Well, in the text, he's the one that got raised from the dead. So if you're not willing to trust him, just forget the whole ball game. You can trust anybody. If you can't trust a person that God raised from the dead to tell you the truth, then you ain't got any capacity for faith. So just forget it. Just go on about your rat killing, because you're not going to ever understand if you're not going to trust. And if you can't trust somebody raised from the dead, then who can you ever trust? That is the demonstrated power action that argues that Jesus was who he said he was. Paul argues that everywhere. 1 Corinthians 15 is fundamental. We know Jesus is who he said he was because God raised him from the dead. Somebody says, well, I don't believe what he says. I believe what this person over here says. Well, what is that person's credentials? Well, he's got a lot of education. He's got a PhD and all. Well, did he ever die and get raised? No, but, you know, I trust him. Why? This one was dead and raised, and you're going to trust that one. Forget it. You want credentials, you go to the one who's got them. Well, that's the point. So when Paul says that he's an apostle, he's actually claiming that you can trust his words to the very details of them, because Jesus had said, not one jot, not one tittle will pass away till everything that God has said has come to pass. The jot was the Hebrew yod, is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet, and the tittle was the little mark that stuck over the top of the D to make it a D instead of an R in the Hebrew alphabet. It's just a little tiny bitty mark. And Jesus said, not one yod, not one tittle will fail. What God says, he means. It's going to be. When you hear from an apostle, you're hearing every letter, every word, every sentence, every paragraph, as if God himself was talking to you. So you can believe it. So the real issue here is that Paul was making his play in Galatians chapter 1 for the Galatians' confidence. Remember this about the Galatian situation. Paul had walked into the various cities of the area of Galatia. He had no prior exposure to these people. They didn't know him from Adam. He got to where everybody was, the marketplace or whatever, and he began raising his voice and talking about Jesus of Nazareth, whom God raised from the dead, whom God appointed Christ, and, you know, and people were saying, who is this? What is this stuff I'm hearing? And especially the Jews, because they knew the words Christ, and, you know. So then Paul would do something that was so obviously supernatural that it made it very difficult for his hearers to say, I don't believe you. It's like that story we read last time about Elymas the magician, who said, Sergius Paulus, don't believe these guys. And Paul said, you son of the devil, how long are you going to do this? He said, you're not going to be able to see for a while. And all of a sudden the guy can't see. Well, what's Sergius Paulus going to think? Well, he's going to think that he just heard the truth. And he had, so he believed. So the point I'm making here is, when Paul went into Galatia, he didn't go with a backlog of people who were just falling all over themselves trying to hear from this apostle. And all. They didn't know him. They didn't know anything. But they knew supernatural power when they saw it. And when they heard the words and the Spirit of God confirmed the truthfulness in their inner man, and then they had miraculous demonstration of power on the outside, they had two combined things that came together, and they believed. They believed what Paul said. They believed and were born again, and they were forgiven of all their sins, and they got this eternal life thing, and whew. And then Paul went to the next town. He went to the next town. He did the same thing. Well, some of them got so mad they stoned him, and then they dragged him out of the city because, as far as they are concerned, he was dead. And he may well have been. We don't know for sure. The text doesn't actually say he was dead. It says he is as if dead. But Paul does refer in the letters to the Corinthians to a guy that got caught up in the third heaven, whether he's in the body or out of the body, he didn't know, and he was talking about himself. So I think he died. Went into the third heaven, got these revelations that couldn't be spoken, and I explained that. Why was that? Anyway, then he was raised fairly quickly, came back into his body, got up, walked back into town. Didn't we just haul you out of here dead? You know, he says, I told you about this resurrected God that I'm telling you about, who died for your sins. And if you'll put your trust in him, you'll be forgiven. I told you that. Well, some more people believed because they'd seen the miraculous. Well, then he went to the next town, same thing happened. The point is, he didn't stay anywhere very long. Week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, gone. After he left, here comes a bunch of smart theologians, Jewish background types, and they say,
You guys been hearing from this guy that calls himself Paul about a Jesus of Nazareth? Well, he's really not an apostle. And so the Galatians are saying,
what? What? I thought he was an apostle. I thought we could trust him.
No, you can't trust him.
Oh, we can't?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then we won't trust him. How do we get to heaven then?
Well, you got to go back and start doing all the things the law said. You got to be circumcised and all that.
Oh, we got to do all that?
Yeah. Oh, okay. And Paul hears about it. He says,
did I waste my time there?
That's what he says. I'm scared of you guys. It looks to me like I wasted my time there. Here you are willing to believe those men who have no credentials. Did they raise anybody from the dead while they were there telling you that I'm not an apostle? Did you stone them and they come back to life? Did they heal anybody? Were they able to cast out any demons? Were they able to do anything that proved that they had any integrity or credentials?
Well, no, but they sure sound like they knew what they were talking about.
He said, well, I sounded like I knew what I was talking about too when I was there. You believed me, but it was because you saw the proof of it. So what is this? Ah! He wants to pull his hair out. Well, that's the book of Galatians. It's Paul's hair being pulled out, you know. But my point is this. He's trying to establish himself as an apostle because he doesn't want anything from them. Motivation, he's Paul. You ain't got anything I want. But I want something for you that you can't have if you don't trust me. So I want you to believe that I'm an apostle. I want you to believe that when I speak, you're hearing from Jesus who was raised from the dead. I want you to believe that. Well, how, Paul? How are we supposed to believe it? Well, just look at what's been going on and do a little thinking. That's chapter 3, verse 1. Oh, foolish Galatians, who bewitched you? I just want to know one thing. He just forced their logic. Well, he said, just stop. Ask yourself a few simple questions. Who are these guys that are lying to you? What are their credentials?
Well, one of them graduated from this seminary. He's gone.
I had a guy write to me one time, an email. He said, where'd you go to school? Where did you get your education? I said, I wrote back, can you imagine anybody asking the Apostle Paul, where'd you get your education? Where'd you go to school? I said, all that stuff means absolutely nothing. What matters is whether I'm telling you the truth or not. If you can't see what I'm telling you is true from the scriptures that I'm explaining to you, then don't believe me. But don't say, well, I don't believe him because he didn't go to that school. Credentials in an apostle setting was the ability to cast out demons, heal diseases, raise the dead in the name of Jesus. It was even the ability to stick your hand down close to the fire, have a snake latch on to you, pump all that venom in you, and you just shake it off in the fire and go get some more firewood. No heart attack. No pain, no nothing. He just acted like it didn't happen. Everybody says,
did you see that?
We might ought to listen to what he has to say because he's obviously favored by the gods. That was the whole issue. When Paul says, Paul, an apostle, he's not contradicting. Paul is his motivation. Apostle is his identity as the representative, the speaker for God. That you're either going to believe him or you don't. And if you don't, it's going to come back on you as having rejected the one who's sinning. And if you do, you're going to get the benefit as if it was the one who sent him had said it himself. Because he's an apostle. So the issue is that Paul wants the Galatians to believe the book of Galatians. He wants them to believe every jot and tittle. He wants them. Why? The issue is that apostleship is the statement of God's use of surrogates to communicate his message with authority, with integrity, so that those who believe those words can possess eternal life, the eternal forgiveness of sins, the eternal glory that is designed to come, a participation in the kingdom of God, the residence in the New Jerusalem, the ability to flit around all over the place in heaven just whenever you want to go do
and just enjoy yourself forever. It all depends on whether you're going to buy these words or not. And that's the future. And in the present, the quality of your experience will be determined by whether you believe what he says or not. And even the issue of walking by the Spirit, which is Galatians 5, is rooted in this word apostle, because Paul knows what faith is. Faith is a grain of seed that, if it is allowed to germinate and start to grow, it will completely uproot every competitor, and it will push its way into the life of the individual until it's permeated his whole life. That's faith. The difference is that people today think faith is some kind of wishful dreaming that doesn't have to affect your life at all. Paul knew that wasn't faith. When you believe something that God has said is true, it does something in your values and in your faith system in a very profound way, so that from then on, all of your life is being affected by it. I used this illustration the other day when I built my little shed in North Carolina so I could store all my stuff in it. I just went down to Lowe's and bought a bunch of concrete blocks, and I laid them on their side so that I'd have basically a concrete floor just made out of blocks. So I took all this time and trouble, and I scraped this level clear, and I put, you know, dirt down so it's all level, I thought. And I laid all these blocks in there, and it's just, you know. About 3 years later, I couldn't believe how uneven this floor was, and why is that block sticking up like that? And I reached down and I pulled it up, and there's this root that was unpersuaded by the presence of my block that it shouldn't be there. It just said, I'm going to do this. And that's the way faith is. It sends out its roots and it starts subverting our lives and changing them into whatever this faith demands. So the most effective resistance that can be done to faith is to undercut its core issue, and that is, what do you believe? The words of the apostle are what we're supposed to believe. That's the content of the faith. He was speaking for Jesus. What Jesus wants us to believe is what he said. So if we believe those things, it's going to change everything over time. Our loves are going to change. Those are our values. What we believe is going to change, because that's the nature of it. So when Paul writes to the Galatians, what's at stake? Remember, the book of Galatians has its niche in the New Testament as the book of methodology. This is the book about how it works. Faith is the issue. It's no accident he spends two chapters proving that he's an apostle. So if you think tonight was long on a word apostle, just think we still got two chapters to go because we've only covered two words. Well, maybe by the end of the time we get the whole two chapters done, we'll be convinced that we can believe this. And if we're convinced we can believe it, perhaps we will believe it. And if we do believe it, then you just have to be aware your values are going to change. What you think is important is going to change. What you believe is true is going to change. And all of a sudden you'll discover, you know, I used to just think I'd die if I couldn't have this. And you don't even want it anymore because it didn't matter. It's not valuable. It's trash. It's junk. That's what the issue of faith does. It changes our values and what we hold on to as true. And that's at the root of this whole issue. When a person claims to be an apostle, he better be able to back up the claim. But if he can, then his hearers are duty-bound to believe what he says, because they're going to face the one who's sinning. Okay? Are we finished?